The headlines: Iran says its findings show that the deadly shooting attack at the Azeri embassy in Tehran was not terrorist-related and rather driven by personal motives. The Russian president says crimes against civilians and ethnic cleansing are organized by neo-Nazis in Ukraine. We also have some news and updates from U.S. police brutality against minority groups. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran says that its findings show that the deadly shooting attack at the Azeri embassy in Tehran was not terrorist-related and rather driven by personal motives.
Our security and police apparatuses believe that the manner of the operation confirms that this was not an organized and terrorist operation. It was motivated by personal reasons.
Amir Abdullahian stressed that such incidents are not unprecedented. He pointed to similar attacks on Iranian diplomats in the UK, China, and Iraq in recent years, and the assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey in 2016. Earlier, the Iranian foreign minister also spoke on the phone with his Azeri counterpart. Amir Abdullahian warned of enemy plots to take advantage of the incident and damage Tehran-Baku relations. Jehun Bayram, for his part, welcomed Amir Abdullahian's proposal for a joint investigation into the shooting. And the gunman shot dead an Azeri diplomat and wounded two other embassy staff after storming the building earlier on Friday. He was arrested shortly after the attack. The attacker claims that his Azeri wife entered the embassy months ago and never returned. Findings by Press TV show Western media outlets duped by a fraudster who claimed to have been arrested, tortured, and on death row in the country in connection with the recent riots. The truth about Hassan Firouzi's story came out after the 34-year-old was arrested trying to escape the country. Firouzi was deep in the red and needed to dodge creditors, so he fabricated the story of his arrest over the riots and sold it to Western media, including those in the UK, to secure asylum. According to the Western narrative, he had slipped into a coma due to torture and was on the verge of execution. However, as Western media were still focused on the story of Firouzi as a victim of physical violence and in custody, he was caught fleeing Iran in good physical and mental health. Iran has repeatedly questioned the coverage of its internal issues by Western media, and Iranians across the country have held rallies condemning the desecration of the Holy Quran in Europe. People took to the streets in the capital, Tehran, and other cities following Friday prayers. They said the heinous acts are meant to provoke and inflame the sentiments of more than 2 billion Muslims worldwide. The protesters called on European authorities to put an end to hostilities against Islam. Bahrain saw similar protests. Protesters gathered in the capital, Manama, despite heightened security measures. The desecration of Islam's holy book also triggered protests in Bangladesh. Demonstrators gathered outside a mosque in the capital, Dhaka, after Friday prayers. Angry Muslims in Afghanistan also marched in Kabul and other major cities across the country. On Sunday, a Dutch politician tore up a copy of the Quran in the city of The Hague. It followed a move by a politician in Sweden to burn a copy of the Holy Book outside the Turkish embassy. Many Muslim governments, including Iran, Pakistan, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates, have slammed the acts of sacrilege.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, tempers are running high in Pakistan over the repeated Islamophobic incidents by some European countries in recent days. Outraged Pakistanis took to the streets of the capital, Islamabad, after Friday prayers to condemn the West for what they call its malicious anti-Islamic agenda.
Burning of Muslims' holy book by these Western nations proved that Islamophobic acts were not an expression of freedom of speech, but extremism. Sadly, extremism exists and is growing everywhere in Europe. It's time for European nations to think about who's promoting extremism by desecrating other religions.
Protesters chanted slogans and vented their anger against the silence of the West regarding repeated incidents of desecration of Holy Quran and the Prophet Muhammad. Demonstrators also called on Muslim nations to boycott European goods over what they describe as the West's insolent behavior.
Quran Pak jala rahe hain.
We strongly condemn the blasphemous incident of desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. The incident is the worst and most heartbreaking act in Europe. There is no room for such a sad incident in a civilized society.
Demonstrators are demanding that the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, known as OIC, raise its voice against the growing intolerance against Islam and anti-Muslim acts across the globe.
It's time for the OIC to play its role in urging Muslim nations to stand united against Western conspiracies. Europe wants to ignite Muslims by doing such blasphemous acts. Once we are united, Europe will not dare to repeat such Islamophobic acts.
The countrywide rallies came days after Pakistan denounced what it described as the abhorrent act of desecration of the Quran in Sweden and the Netherlands, saying such acts disrespect Muslims across the globe.
Condemnations continue to pour in from Muslim countries across the world. Yemen, Qatar, along with other Islamic nations, joined Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey to denounce the desecration. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
At least 7 people are killed and 3 others injured in a shooting at a synagogue in Israeli-occupied Al-Quds. The regime says a gunman has been shot dead. He's been identified as 21-year-old Palestinian Al-Ghamkhairi. He's a resident of the eastern part of Al-Quds. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has praised the attack. The movement says it was a natural response to Israel's bloody raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, Palestinian Islamic Jihad has also praised the operation. For more on that story, we're now joined by academic and political commentator Mr. Mohsen Saleh, who's joining us now on the line from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Saleh, welcome to the program. First of all, I want to get your perspective on how events have transpired over the past few days in the occupied West Bank.
I guess it's about time for the Israeli occupation and to, invasion and the atrocities committed by the Zionist forces in Al-Quds and other places in Jenin, in West Bank, in Nablus, in everywhere in the West Bank. It's about time for them to taste the bitterness of killing and demolishing houses and kidnapping Palestinians and putting them in the prisons and attacking the Aqsa Mosque and all the sacred places in Palestine and especially in Al-Quds. And I guess the Palestinians, they have the right to defend themselves all the way from 50 years or 70 years or more in order to keep their rights working. And it's about time also for the Arabs to understand that the Palestinians, they have the right to be free in their land, to have this state, have the authorities, and not allow the Israeli occupation to continue in their killings, in their massacres against the Palestinians, and attack at any time the camps and the cities, and now the Palestinian Authority doing nothing actually. So I guess it's good to see that people who have been oppressed and attacked for decades are really moving in order to regain their rights in life and independence.
Sure. Another thing that we'd like to address here, Mr. Saleh, is the not just the international inaction on behalf of the international community, the United Nations being at its helm. I want you to discuss that also, the issue of the blackout by the mainstream Western media about events that are taking place in occupied Palestinian territories, the day-to-day Israeli violations that are being carried out against the rights of the Palestinians.
Absolutely. The Western powers, most of them, they have participated in this kind of killing against the Palestinians and the occupation, and encouraged the Israelis in order to continue in their worse attacks against the Palestinians. So we won't expect from the Western powers, especially and the United States, to condemn such operations from the Palestinians. While when the Israelis do all these atrocities, all these attacks, all these hostilities against the Palestinians, we hear no word from the Western powers or from the Western media, because the Israeli lobbies in the West and in the United States are controlling and ordering such media. So the Palestinians and the Arabs and the oppressed people, they really should depend on themselves, on their heads and in their bodies and in their minds and in their all the capabilities they might have in order to regain their existence in this world. For a long time, they have really were snapped from this, and they were taken out of this world. So the Western media should know now any attacks from the Zionists, especially by this what so-called vizier or minister Ben Gafir, who attacks the Aqsa and says and threaten every time that to attack Al-Aqsa. They should know that there is a price for that.
All right, thanks a lot. Academic and political commentator Mohsen Salda joining us on the line from Beirut. Elsewhere, the Russian president says neo-Nazis are committing crimes in Ukraine, an allegation Vladimir Putin has repeatedly cited for the military offensive against Kiev. Putin said there's evidence of crimes against civilians, ethnic cleansing, and punitive actions organized by neo-Nazis in Ukraine. He underlined that forgetting the lessons of history leads to the repetition of terrible tragedies. The Russian president stressed that denazification was one of the goals of the military operation he ordered in Ukraine last February. Putin said attempts to deny Russia's contributions to victory over Germany under Adolf Hitler actually equate to justifying the crimes of Nazism. Those attempts, he added, also opened the way for the revival of Nazism's deadly ideology. Putin stressed his forces are bravely fighting that evil in Ukraine. That's a claim Kiev has contested. The French foreign minister has also condemned Putin's remarks as appalling and shocking. While more European countries join the pledge campaign to send tanks to Ukraine in a military buildup in the country's war against Russia, Spain's defense minister says Madrid seeks to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine. In the spring, the official did not specify the number of the heavy weaponry. Poland is also saying it will send an additional 60 tanks to Kiev. The UK, Canada, and Germany have also made their own pledges of delivering tanks to Ukraine. The European countries made the decisions after the US president announced Washington's will to provide Ukraine with the heavy weaponry.
The United States has decided to give Ukraine 31 battle tanks, the most powerful offensive weapons the Pentagon has sent yet. The increased direct involvement by Washington and its NATO allies hinders chances for a diplomatic solution and has led to open threats of an escalation into nuclear war.
We heard Annalena Baerbock say in the Council of Europe Tuesday or Wednesday of this week that we are at war with Russia. And so there's no there's no question about what's really going on here. And there's certainly no question in the minds of people in Russia who have all this weaponry being wheeled up to their borders.
The announcement came just one day after Ukraine's government saw its biggest corruption scandal and mass resignation since the unrest with Russia began, bringing down a top presidential advisor and a dozen leading officials. Public support for Ukraine has fallen almost 25% from its highest level last March. Recent polls show that 53% disapprove of the way President Joe Biden is handling the situation, and that 47% of Americans want Kiev to settle for peace soon. The same poll noted that if people think Ukraine is winning the war, then they are much more supportive of more aid.
What are you sending the money for? Well, protect freedom and, well, it's being successful. Okay, some people will buy that. If it's not being successful, the number of people that will buy that goes down precipitously. And so that's, the happy talk is necessary to make it seem like we're not just opening the window and pouring the money out for, onto a flame or whatever.
Since last year, Ukraine has received over $50 billion in military aid from the West, which is slightly more than Russia's entire 2022 defense budget. However, the Republican takeover of the House of Representatives has included promises to rein in the Democratic Party's war spending, as polls say over half of Republicans no longer support funding Ukraine. Kiev has already shifted their demands to fighter jets, which will be the next debate within NATO. The conflict continues to escalate, with few voices for diplomacy heard within the United States. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Anger once again boiling in the U.S. over police brutality against African Americans. People have taken to the streets demanding justice for 29-year-old Tyre Nichols, beaten to death earlier this month.
Please don't shoot me dead. I got my hands above my head.
People marched in New York City and Memphis after police released footage of an encounter between five officers and Nichols during a traffic stop. It happened in Memphis on January the 7th. Video shows the black officers violently kicking, punching, and pepper spraying Nichols, who cries for help. He died in hospital 3 days later. The five officers have been charged with second-degree murder. President Joe Biden has already appealed for calm. U.S. police brutality against black people has been a source of public anger for years now, but the issue has remained under the spotlight following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis back in 2020. A senior U.S. general has warned of a possible war with China over Taiwan as early as 2025, as the island remains a bone of contention between the world's two biggest economies. General Mike Minahan issued the warning in an internal memo that first emerged on social media, but was later confirmed as genuine by the Pentagon. Minahan called for the maximum battle readiness. He said the main goal should be, quote, to deter and, if required, defeat China. He reasoned out that Taiwan's presidential elections next year would offer China an excuse for aggression. At the time when the U.S. would be busy with its own race for the White House, Beijing considers Taiwan as an inseparable part of its territory. It has repeatedly warned against the island's growing diplomatic and military nexus with the U.S. And Peru's Congress has turned down the president's request to bring forward elections to December 2023. Lawmakers already agreed last month to bring forward elections from 2026 to April 2024. President Dina Boluarte had demanded them to call the vote for December to help the country get out of a weeks-long political crisis, a crisis which the president described as a quagmire began in early December last year. That's when former President Pedro Castillo was removed from office. And that's a wrap for now. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
There are reports that the EU's largest gas field will be closed soon. The Dutch government is set to stop production at the Groningen gas field later this year. The Dutch State Secretary for Mining has told the Financial Times that the rising risk of earthquakes makes the site dangerous to operate. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, the Dutch government is set to stop production at Groningen gas field later this year. The state secretary for extractive industries, Hans Vigilbrief, has told the Financial Times the site is already producing only a fraction of its capacity and it is very dangerous to keep operating it, according to the official. He told the news outlet, we won't open up more because of safety issues. I'm not going to do it because it means that you increase the chances of earthquakes, which I don't want to be responsible for. It's very, very simple. Everybody who has some knowledge of earthquake danger tells me that it's really very dangerous to keep on producing at Groningen. I'm quite convinced it's wise to close it down, he continued. The official noted that he plans to shut down the site by October 1st, but this will depend on whether the EU has enough gas after the winter. If necessary, the field might continue to operate until October 2024. There are reportedly about $1 trillion worth of gas reserves at Groningen, which was opened in 1963 and produced over 50 billion cubic meters of gas at its peak 10 years ago. However, because the extraction process led to earthquakes that threatened the homes of local residents, output was eventually cut. Up to 100 drilling-induced tremors have been registered around Groningen annually since 1980s. With roughly 160,000 claims for damage to property field to date, according to the FT. The Netherlands came under pressure from EU authorities to boost production at the site last year, when a drop in supplies from Russia sent gas prices on the continent soaring to historic highs. Although The Hague rejected these calls, it did postpone plans to shut down the field. Its annual output was cut to 2.8 billion cubic meters, as producing more than 5 BCM would heighten the risk of earthquakes, the official added. Russia used to be the largest gas supplier to the EU, accounting for 40% of total EU gas consumption in 2021. Last year, Moscow was forced to halt gas deliveries through the Yamal-Europe and Nord Stream 1 pipelines due to Ukraine-related sanctions. At the end of September, deliveries through Nord Stream 1 stopped completely after the pipeline was sabotaged. Russia continues to deliver gas to certain European buyers via a transit line through Ukraine and the Turkish Stream pipeline through Turkey, but volumes are only a fraction of what they were in 2021. Industry experts warn that the EU, while relatively secure in supplies at the moment due to high storage levels, may face difficulties when the time comes to refill stores for next winter. The website of Oil Price also noted the Dutch government plans to close the Groningen gas field this year, despite Europe's precarious supply position. Groningen is the largest gas field in Europe. The field is dangerous, a government official from The Hague told the Financial Times, and the government has no plans to boost production from it. We won't open up more because of the safety issues, the official said. Production at Groningen has been curtailed substantially, and there were plans in place to phase out production altogether because of increased seismic activity in the vicinity of the field even before the energy crisis began in 2021 in the European continent. As gas prices began to climb in the autumn of 2021 and then took off in the spring of 2022, some began speculating that the Netherlands could keep the field operating to contribute to filling the gap in gas supply left by Russian pipeline deliveries. The Dutch government was skeptical about that from the start and instead suggested production be extended. Although at a minimum rate of some 2.8 billion cubic meters, now this too is being reconsidered. It's very, very simple. Everybody who has some knowledge of earthquake danger tells me that it's very dangerous to keep on. I'm quite convinced it's wise to close it down, the official said. Since 1980s, the Financial Times noted, there have been some 100 earthquakes annually around Groningen, resulting in more than 150,000 claims for property damage. The operator of the field, a Shell Exxon joint venture, was ordered to start reducing output in 2013 with a view to shutting the field down eventually.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Palestinians killed in one day. Two were killed the day before. 30 killed so far this year, and only 26 days have passed in the month of January. Such is the state of affairs of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. And when it comes to reaction from the international community, it appears that there isn't enough, even though Palestinian lives are being extinguished. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the issue of Palestine is not given the attention that it rightfully deserves, especially when it comes to an extreme right-wing cabinet that is out to apparently erase Palestinians off the Palestinian territory. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Leif Maruf, activist and political commentator, joins us from Beirut. Also joining us is Zakir Ahmad Mayat, an attorney, activist, and political analyst who joins us from Johannesburg.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Laith Maruf, I'll start with you. Obviously, this is a shocking and terrible and sad day, to say the least. I'm not keen to use adjectives in an opening question, but how else can you look at the massacre that has taken place in one single day where 10 Palestinians have been killed? There are reports that there could be more overall to have been to have died in the occupied territories, but we have 10 so far for what has happened. I'm not too sure what else to say, but I can say even more that the killing included 6 children and an elderly woman. What's your reaction to what has occurred, first of all?
My reaction is that this comes less than a day and a half from Netanyahu visiting Jordan and meeting with the king of Jordan, which is at the moment as a country boiling over for because of the crash of the economy and because of their brethren being killed in the West Bank of Palestine. So the question comes now is this what Netanyahu delivered? What did he deliver to the king of Jordan for him to be able to do such a thing less than a day and a half from his visit to that country? The crimes of the Zionists will continue in Palestine until the Palestinians are able to defeat their occupiers, and we need more resistance, and Jenin is showing the way forward to the Palestinian people. Today was a heroic day for Jenin. It is a sad day, of course, for all the innocence that was lost against the occupier, fighting against the occupier, but it is also a proud day for Palestine, where the Zionists were not able to go into the heart of Jenin because of the first resistance.
We always need to watch out for the, not watch out, but mention and highlight, Zakir Ahmed, the narrative and how the media twists the way that it's being reported. And I'm taking just one example here where it says 9 Palestinians have been killed during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank, the deadliest in years. So far, sounds okay. But then it says Palestinian officials say. So it's kind of throwing that from the viewpoint of Palestinians reporting it. And then it says a woman aged 60 was reported among the dead in the flashpoint town of Jenin. And then it says the Israeli military said its troops went in to arrest, and it calls them Islamic Jihad militants who were planning major attacks. Now, we know these are fighters, and then it talks about an event that has not even taken place. How can that even justify logic when they go and then as a result, 10 have been killed for what? For maybe attacks that may have been planned?
The narrative is particularly important within the sphere of global attention. It's very hard for Israel to justify its actions when it has such a right-wing government. Individuals such as Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, both of them are extreme right-wing, so severe in their viewpoints that even the Americans were concerned about the election of this government. Therefore, they have to use every trick in the book to try and justify these actions. These actions, however, are not just isolated to pure Israeli brutality. There's a system behind this. There's a strategic objective behind this, and one that has not been spoken about is what is the reason for this massive escalation that you spoke about at the very introduction of this program. This is a systematic program to reestablish the Palestinian Authority. This is not something that I've come up with. It's something that's very clear from Israeli think tanks such as the JISS, the Jerusalem Institute for Security Studies, as well as the Israeli Institute for National Security Studies, INSS. Both of them are talking about the restoration of the monopoly of violence to the Palestinian Authority. Hence, you see these violent incursions into the cities in occupied Palestine. So what you have here is the Israeli regime trying to reestablish their collaborators and the power of their collaborators, and they are prepared to massacre the innocent as they do so and spin a false narrative within the media. This is a full campaign. We cannot just look at it in isolation, and we must understand the strategic objectives. I believe that we are in a very dangerous fork right now, considering the military exercises that are taking place within Israel, and that's also a possibility that we must explore perhaps later in the show.
Okay, so if I was to understand you correctly, you're saying that in order for the PA and its authority to be reestablished, meaning that it has lost it, but for it to be reestablished in the occupied territories, Israel has committed what it has done, and then in that way, the PA, in collaboration with Israel, can then reestablish its authority and therefore maintain some kind of control over the Palestinians. Is that correct in how I understood what you said?
That is precisely correct. This is in a document that was issued today. It was an article that was written by the professor of the JISS, Professor Ephraim Inbar. He said it today. He said that we are seeing now a Lebanization of the West Bank, a proliferation of military movements that is undermining and could possibly collapse the Palestinian Authority, and therefore Israel needs to step in. He was speaking specifically about the situation within the West Bank. This goes further in the INSS, where they are talking about, and this links to what my fellow panelist has just said, what was discussed with the King of Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom. In the INSS report, it says with the collapse of Abbas, it's a 100-page report, came out in December of last year. The title was The Day After Abbas. They talk about the Hashemite Kingdom actually participating in taking over part of the responsibilities in the West Bank. We are at a very serious precipice, and what we are seeing now is just the front of it, the massacres of the Palestinians, the strategy behind it.
All right, so Leith Maruf, what do you think about what our guest there has said? Do you agree with him, first of all? I mean, we're talking also, I should mention that the PA has made an announcement just in the past hour or so that it's not going to continue its security cooperation with Israel, which many ask, why does it even cooperate with Israel when it comes to security on Palestinians when so many are getting killed?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't believe what Abbas is saying or the Palestinian Authority right now about cutting the security coordination with the Zionist occupiers until we see it in action. My colleague here is exactly connecting the same process. We have two collaborating regimes, the Palestinian Authority and the Jordanian Hashemite elite, who are courting Netanyahu right now to save their own positions. Because remember, if actually Ben-Gvir and the extreme Zionists, if there's such a thing that is not an extreme Zionist, achieve stripping the Aqsa Mosque from the Hashemite, patronage, it will mean the end of Hashemite existence, because the only reason the Hashemites exist in Islamic tradition and have any royal status is to be custodians of the holy sites. They've already lost Mecca and Medina to Al-Saud, and this is the last thing that keeps them in any shape or form in a royal status. So here we have both the Palestinian Authority and the Hashemites working with the Netanyahu regime to try to save the apparatuses of control within the West Bank as the resistance increases. And at the same time, we see that actually today, for instance, much of the resistance that happened included people that are members of the armed wings of the PLO, Fatah specifically, along with the Hamas and Islamic Jihad. So it means that what we see is a collapse of the Fatah apparatus. Beyond the collapse of the Palestinian Authority that we will witness very shortly, we are seeing also the collapse of Fatah and maybe eventually its control of the PLO.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, so we're looking at two different issues since we're talking about what you both have presented. One is the issue of Jordan and its custodianship of Al-Aqsa in terms of its status there. And then the other, we're talking about the PA and in terms of its authority. So my question, first of all, Zakir Ahmed comes, and I think it's a logical one, is why should this, PA, on the PA side, on the PA issue, why should that come at the cost of losing Palestinian lives? Couldn't there be another way of approaching the PA and its, I guess, control over Palestine?
It's the same approach that the apartheid regime used here in South Africa to establish its control. They created Bantustans, various different homelands, created military forces trained, funded, and supported by the apartheid regime, the enforcers within this region. It was movements such as APLA, the armed movement of the PAC, and Mponto Wesizwe, the armed movement of the ANC, that fought against this. And similarly, we are seeing the same situation playing out within Palestine. What has happened now is that the collaborators are panicking. They have now reached out to their illegitimate donor, Israel, and said, please come and help us. So what is happening now is that what you are seeing is the sacrificing of the Palestinian people to ensure that certain corrupt collaborators remain in power, and this is bound to fail. Surely they have noticed that in South Africa it failed. Surely it's going to fail within Palestine. This indicates to us that we should not entertain on any of our resistance platforms, any of our solidarity platforms, representatives of the Palestinian Authority. They are collaborators in South Africa. If we had to entertain individuals who had cooperated with the security branch or any other form of security apparatus of the apartheid state, surely they would have been necklaced. We should not allow this. We need to expose these individuals who are sacrificing the Palestinian people for who they are, your collaborators that don't care about the Palestinians.
On the issue of Jordan, thank you for that. On the issue of Jordan now, let's move on to that, Laith Maruf. And I really thank you for bringing this up, because this kind of went outside of the realm of the program in terms of the certain topics that you wanted to cover. But this is something that you now brought up, and of course I am scrambling to get some information on this. But yet I do see here that on the 24th, Netanyahu actually had paid a surprise visit to Jordan, and I think you mentioned that, and he said that he vowed to uphold the Al-Aqsa status. Now, you're saying that if that doesn't happen, that Jordan would lose its Hashemite, I guess, rule, in a sense, if I, again, understood you correctly. Now, what are we looking at if that doesn't happen with this extreme, and as you said, how extreme can it be, but you're looking at the characters of this extreme cabinet. Do you think they're going to let go of Al-Aqsa? Because all looks of it, with the way they're moving and plowing ahead, they're breaking all barriers, it seems like. And Al-Aqsa obviously is going to be one of them under the watch of Gavir, in terms of either the prayer restrictions that are going to probably get more, and, of course, not allowing even Palestinians into the mosque, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, look, this today's activities and attacks on Jenin come just, a day and a half, 2 days after Smotril became the Minister of Internal, took the actual full position. So now we see a direct a result of having an extremist settler, Kahanist, in charge of what they call internal security and the apparatus that, of security in the West Bank. This is the results of it. So this action wouldn't have happened had Netanyahu not got the okay, both from the Palestinian Authority and the King of Jordan, to attack now, after the whole population is on edge in both Palestine and Jordan. And we can see an agreement happening there on this actions. Luckily, it seems like the Palestinian, resistance movements in Jenin and Nablus and so forth have matured to a point where they can resist and successfully repel an invasion into the city. This means that even if the Palestinian Authority wants to take back Jenin, it cannot take back Jenin, even with a direct Israeli involvement, as we saw today, without a massacre larger than the one that happened in 2002, which means there will be a war in all across Palestine. If this continues, this pressure, we're already at the edge today of a return to direct military, you know, full battle across all of historic Palestine, like happened last year.
Well, okay, so what's going to make that not happen, Zakir Ahmad? Do you think that Israel is going to stop? I mean, we're looking at really from April of last year, continuously increasing the raids, and now for the past months, and looking at the 26 days, and today being the culmination of what we're looking at, which is about 10 deaths so far, which is one of the worst. I mean, do you think that Israel is going to stop there? And if you say yes, or if you say no, that is, then that means would that scenario that our guest in Beirut said occur, where you're going to see a war that's going to pretty much engulf all of occupied Palestine?
I concur with the panelist from Beirut. He's 100% correct. What we see is a direct path to a massive escalation. As I referred previously to the 100-page memorandum that was issued by INSS in December of last year, the end part when they said that if the Palestinian Authority collapses, what they would be forced to do would be to occupy the entire West Bank. Yes, we know the legal status is occupied, but that means a full deployment of military throughout the West Bank, putting permanent curfews, etc. This would lead to an inevitable escalation. We know the Joint Operations Room has already issued a statement. There was an emergency meeting this evening of the various factions, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and many other smaller factions. Now, this comes at, there's another strategic point that's taking place. There's been numerous conferences over the last 2 months, and particular effort has been placed in this last month to discuss the reservist failure within Israel, meaning that they are short of reservists should they enter into a multi-front war. And this has been admitted by Major General Gadi Eisenkot and many of the other senior echelons of the Israeli military. However, in this period of time, we have a very strategic change. We have 6,400 U.S. troops, approximately 100 U.S. aircraft. There's one strike carrier group of the U.S. Navy, so that means aircraft carrier and supporting military infrastructure, 6 ships. These are huge amounts of military equipment. These are force multipliers. Therefore, I think that the Israelis are taking the opportunity now to try and strike the West Bank, try and stabilize their collaborator, and to ensure that the restoration is successful. Should they fail, and they are aware of this, this might lead to a large-scale war, a regional war, and now they have the United States there as a force multiplier. I don't think we can look at these elements as coincidental, and we cannot look at their own military literature as coincidental. It paints a very bleak picture, and I think that it is quite dangerous, and I do believe that the resistance axis is ready, Al-Muqawama al-Islamiyah is ready for engagement, and it is a continuation of Saif al-Quds, in my opinion. It's going to spell the end of Israel should this continue in this trajectory with these lunatics such as Etamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich.
Okay, so this is very interesting. If we're going to go with that thesis or that the facts that our guest there in Johannesburg said there, Laith Maruf, let's say that projection comes true, or that speculation does indeed come true. It's not as if Israel has been dealing with Palestinians and the resistance fighters and Palestinians in general who are fighting back. They're also dealing with their own homegrown problem of Israelis who want this cabinet to go. I mean, there's even a movement that's out that calls for 10,000 Israelis at a minimum to move out of Israel until they get the message. If you have that type of a military activity happen, couldn't that backfire on Israel itself and therefore create a huge headache for themselves that may even break them apart?
Yes, and of course, they also have no choice but to do this because the Western Empire ruled from D.C. is collapsing, and because their own internal issues are collapsing from within, they have no choice but to instigate external wars in hopes of slowing down this collapse. So right now, we are just like in the war in Ukraine, we're getting to a point of no return or closing down of options that the players have. Israelis are running out of options. And, you know, a reminder to our listeners, the American military, as our guests from Johannesburg just reminded, is stationed right now there and have been conducting the largest exercise in the history of the Zionist colony with the American military forces, throwing bunker buster, you know, mother of all bombs in the Naqab pristine ecology of the Naqab Desert, in threats to bomb the nuclear facilities of Iran and the rest of, you know, attacking the rest of the axis of resistance if they dare. And so for this attack of, on Jenin to happen right now, it is definitely the Israelis feel safe with the backing of the Americans right there conducting that activity. Imagine right now if an actual, you know, armed resistance starts throwing missiles from Gaza and or multiple attacks happen in the West Bank and a full-out war happens and the Palestinians ask for the backing of the resistance axis in Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. This is going to change the reality. So the Israelis are taking advantage of this moment on multiple levels.
All right, so I got one question to ask. It's the last question. Isn't this another, just this whole scenarios and elements that we covered, a prime example of how this Palestinian issue has been tossed down, a can that's been tossed down the road from one U.S. president to another to have reached what we're looking at based on our conversation in this program to the boiling point that it needs to be addressed, or are we beyond that? Less than a minute, please. Zakir Ahmed.
We're definitely beyond that. I think we're far too far gone on this issue. The situation is that it's like the apartheid regime. It needs to come to an end. Even the human rights organizations acknowledge this. And the only way that you can dismantle the state, unlike the way I see it in South Africa, was that there has to be a war, and this is what Israel recognizes, and that's what we could be heading for. However, they're underestimating the power of Al-Muqawam al-Islamiyah, the resistance faction, and our full support there. I think the world's support is behind the Palestinians.
Thank you for that. We're going to end it there. We do appreciate it. It was a fascinating conversation. Zakir Ahmed Mayat, attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg, and Leith Maruf, thank you for your contribution. Activist and political commentator from Beirut. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tabway and the team. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed. His decree, though...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip, don't rely simply on your age when it comes to increasing, strengthening, and powering up our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah. So, dear listeners, we are talking about ubudiyya, we are talking about the servitude, the obedience, and the worship to the Almighty Allah, the creator of all the worlds and the creator of existence. Now, sometimes in our lives, we come across this idea, this thought that, you know, I'm still young. I have a good 40, 50, 60 years ahead of my life. And so in this facade and this mirage of age, we sometimes have a tendency to not do that which must be done at the present time. It's a kind of procrastination which lasts over multiple years. Of course, one of the things that is directly related to our ubudiyya, our service and our servitude and our obedience to the Almighty Allah is the concept and the action of asking for forgiveness. Now, every single one of us must ask for forgiveness. Of course, repent for the different voluntary and involuntary errors or sins that we make in our daily lives. Now, of course, this asking for forgiveness is because, in reality, committing these sins are a form of disobedience to the Almighty Allah. And being a servant, being a abid, being a worshiper of the Almighty Allah, on our side, it does not